I'd like to take it just a moment. Sometimes we miss important moments, and I shall not want to miss this moment. I just want to look at you folks. You know, I want to thank you all for my sobriety. The first acknowledgement I'd like to make today is the God of my understanding. Without him, I would not be here. Second acknowledgement I would like to make is for my own district, 6, 7, and 6, for the old-timers who were my teachers. My first sponsor was Crawl. I was his pigeon. Second sponsor, Donnie C. from the 24-hour group in Trenton, Nova Scotia. My group is the Hope Group in Stoneton, Nova Scotia. I'd like to share with you that I was a foster child and an orphan. And I'd also like to share with you that I'm a manic, depressive type alcoholic, bipolar. Diagnosed after I came into AA after 3 months sober, which is in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. They too could recover if they had the capability to be honest. Another acknowledgement, and this is it for me, and I want to acknowledge a message that was carried to me in the drug dependency. That message came by a tape by John D'Inye, who was labeled, who lived in the flophouse, who got sober, and he did things basically no other human being would likely do to in his recovery to get well. He inspired me to do the same, because you see, it took me 16 and a half years to say, I am a recovered alcoholic, and I heard that man say that was Mal J. from Truro. Thank you. Hope you'll be patient with me because our format's a little different here. I'd like to remind the attendees that their special needs seating sections are exclusive for those who are in some way or handicapped. And I would like to ask for a moment of silence and gratitude for the AA recoveries of the past 70 years. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I now would like to carry on the meeting with, there is three speakers, and ladies first when I grew up, and I would like to call up Sarah. Is it?
Hi, everybody. My name is Sarah, and I'm an alcoholic. It's great to be here in Toronto with all of you. I would like to tell you that 9 years ago today, I retired from my job at the General Service Office. And when I left the office, I would never guess I'd be here today, I'll tell you. I loved everything about, you know, so much about working there, and I learned so much. But the one thing I had no regrets when I left is that I wouldn't be standing in front of a podium talking anymore. And I thought, never, ever again. And it really went right through my head when I left. I wouldn't be doing this. And yet when I got the letter of invitation to come and speak, I wrote right back and said yes. And I'm really very honored. And to tell you the truth, they had to do this lineup with me first because I still wasn't sure my nerves would hold up all the rest of the day. When I came to AA, I was so worn out and so guilt-ridden and filled with anger and resentments and simply had the weight of the world on my shoulders. I was the type that would well up with tears. I couldn't look at anyone in the eye. I was just so ashamed of my life and the way I'd been living, and I simply didn't know how to get out of the way I was, to get out of my own way. I loved AA from the beginning, really. I came in and I sat in the back of the room and I listened. And I went around to the other, I got sober in New York City, lots of meetings all of the time, and I went around to all of the meetings, you know, day in and day out. And after about 3 months, I joined the first group I went to and had had a step meeting too. And after about 3 months, this chairman, Wally, got up in front of the step meeting. And I didn't feel light at all. I still had this heaviness with me, and I would still back away from people when I came into AA. It didn't change my personality. I was just very glad to be here. I identified, and I knew I was in the right place. But anyway, this one particular night I came in, and I sat down in the back row, and the chairman, Wally, opened up the meeting and was talking about the steps. And he said that he had, the one thing he always worried about was paying for his sins at the end of the road. He was worried about Judgment Day. And his sponsor said, oh, don't worry about that. You pay for your sins as you go. You don't show up at work, they fire you, and so on and so forth. And for some reason, that to me was my... It was a spiritual awakening. I sat in that back row, and I just started to weep. I knew I was going to be okay, that I would be acceptable, that other people were like me, and I don't know about Judgment Day, but I knew that I would find a way to live my life one day at a time. As I continued in the step meeting and in the other meetings, I realized that all of the steps were really self-exploratory to some degree or other. And it's been my way out of the misery I lived in for so long. Today, the 10th step is actually my favorite step today. It's the one actually I'm better with the 10th step than prayer and meditation, although I'm pretty regular about the prayer and meditation. I can tell right away when something is wrong with me. When I came into AA, I was all tied up in knots all of the time. I couldn't think anything through. I couldn't talk with people, and I was ashamed. In AA, I started to loosen up, be able to talk to people, talk things through. That for me was the big door opening. Hardest thing since I've been in AA, and I'm sure we've all experienced, I did the fourth and fifth step, and I was pretty good after that about keeping up with a regular inventory. But after I was sober for a few years, I met this really great guy, and we planned to get married, and he had been diagnosed with a degenerative illness. And my mother was really unhappy that I had chosen to get married, to go ahead with the marriage. But anyway, I did, and she never let up after that. She was just really said, I can't bear to think of you living with someone who's going to be sick. And from there, I can't tell you, we were so close, my mother and me. We'd been friends. I always thought we were great buddies and friends for years, and I'm sure we were. But whatever happened there, it was the end between us. Let me tell you, I had a resentment you can't believe. And I took her inventory every single day, week after week, month after month, year after year. It really took a long time for me to get to the other side of it. But, of course, I wasn't letting her have her opinion either. And it's just one of those things. But in that time, I was really pretty miserable. We were in different cities and all, but the loss was horrendous to me, the loss of our relationship. And I used to pray and pray. I wrote all these, you know, I would write letters to her saying everything on my mind and tear them up. I tried to work the step in depth. I tried to do a lot of things, and I talked to a lot of people. And eventually I was able to let go of it and came to peace with my mother. As I say, it's never the same again. But I accepted I accepted her opinion, and of course I accepted my opinion. And but I hope, and I don't think I'll ever have anything like that happen again, where something goes on for so long that was really just kind of eating me up alive. Other things happen too that are in the 10th step that are much easier. I love the spot check. It's so quick and it's so easy. And it really prevents the emotional hangovers that can come along with not letting go. And I think that things, even when I came to this convention today, I saw someone, or a couple days ago, I ran into an AA member that I knew from Florida. And I knew he was newly married, just a couple of years. It was his second marriage. He'd been widowed and then recently remarried, and was very pleased. And of course, he's bringing his brand new wife, who knows nothing about it, you know, who knows not too much about AA and Al-Anon without that exposure. And my point is, I walked right up to him, threw my arms around him, kissed him, and said, "Oh, I'm so glad to see you here." And I just left her standing there as if she didn't exist. And anyway, it wasn't, you know, and then he introduced me to her, and we spoke for a few minutes, and I said how glad I was to meet her. But in fact, when I walked away, I thought, oh, boy, was that thoughtless, because I know when I used to bring my husband to functions, he'd say, "I'm so lonesome when I'm there. You know, no one, you know, you all talk to each other and so on." And I know better is my point. And I thought when I walked away, I'm not going to do that again. I don't have to go back and take the 10th step. It would really just, I thought, exasperate it. I just let it go and walked on. And I will say I ran into him the next day. He was by himself at the newsstand. I did have a chance to apologize. And another time, I work as a volunteer in the hospital. I live down in Vero Beach, Florida now, which is fabulous, and I love it. And I'm a volunteer at our local hospital. And I push a magazine cart around to the patients to see if they would like anything to read. And one day I walked into a room, and there was a member of my group there, no one I know well. I just know her from coming to the meetings. And I said, "Mary," I said, "I'm so surprised to see you here. What's wrong?" And I thought, it just came out. It popped out. But my point is, it's just one of those things that happen sometimes. You just do it, and you wish you hadn't done it. And we do have a confidentiality policy at the hospital where we don't get into the patient's business. Anyway, I walked out. She handled it very well. She said, "Oh, I'm fine, and I'm leaving in an hour or something. I'm going." So, but it's one of those things. It's those kind of things where I'm aware of stuff I do, things I do, that where I can be more thoughtful and improve. And I don't have to, in the old days, I used to go home and kind of beat myself over the head and think, "Oh, they think I'm a jerk," and really wear a hair shirt over things that I just got to accept that I did them and let go. Other things, there are other things that happen too that take a little longer to work out. When I first moved to Florida, a woman came to my apartment and knocked on my door and said, I own the rental apartment underneath you, and your pipes leaked all into my home, and here's the bill." And being a little slow-witted, I said, "Oh, well, I'm very glad to meet you." And she walked away, and I looked at the thing. It was 6 months old, the bill. And I called her up. I knew she lived at a development across the street, and I phoned her, and I said, "This is not my bill, and I'm going to mail this back to you, and I'll send you the name and address of the previous owner," which I did. She called me up a couple times after that and said, "Are you sure you're not responsible?" And I said, "Not me." So that was then. That was 9 years ago. A few years after that, she came, and she knocked on my door, and she said, "Your apartment is leaking. Your pipes are draining and leaking into my apartment. It's a mess. Do something. Can you please do something? Do you have a plumber?" she said. So, being helpful and not too bright, I said, "Sure." And I called up the plumber that I'd used, and he came over, and he looked in at the pipes in my bathroom, and they looked fine. He went downstairs. Well, the upshot of the story is, whatever the problems were, it was her pipes, her leaking pipes, and not mine at all. So, anyway, she took the bill. She said, "I'll take care of it," and I said, "Thank you." About 2 weeks later, I got a bill from the plumbing company, and I called her up. I said, "Did you pay the bill?" She said, "Oh, I'm sure I sent the check." I said, "I've got the bill. They're anxious for their money, and I'd really appreciate it if you'd take care of it." "No problem," she said. Well, two or three weeks later, I got another one. And I called up, I got her sick husband on the phone, and I was telling him about how mean she was being, not paying this bill, and not how mean, but just saying that she kept saying she, he said, I said, "I'm really upset." He said, "Oh, I would be too." And I had the optimism to send that bill over to them too. Anyway. By the time I got the letter, that said we're turning this account over to the credit agency in your name and the credit report and that so on, I thought about it and I was so upset. I was so pulled off my own. It got to one of those things where I was casual in the beginning, but then I started to feel anxious, angry, taken, wanting to get even, that kind of thing. And I finally realized this isn't worth it. Sometimes, in the big book, it says we take the 10th step to maintain our sobriety, our emotional balance, and to live a useful life. I was not. I was really becoming obsessed, and I could tell how far off the mark I was. Because it was, I have everything. I mean, I'm a happily retired person, and I'm going around in a circle over this bill, and it's in my mind all the time. So I went ahead and I paid the bill and I went to bed and I started every night for a while praying to have this bad feeling lifted. And you do it long enough and it goes. And I just kept doing it till I didn't feel it at all. And I really haven't thought about it for a very long time. So I think the 10th step works in lots of ways. I was at the bridge club and somebody made a remark, or he made a bid that gave me a bad score. I said, "That was really a terrible bid you made." And I say it with a smile, but I'm very angry. And I'm amazed at my own competitiveness. But anyway, he said there was nothing wrong with my bid. So there was. There just was. And I took it upon myself, to help him understand the area of error of his way. I said, "You better start reading the bidding books if you're going to play, it's one of those things. I'm not tough, and I'm really the type with a loud sound of the first one out of the room. But here I am going after this guy because I'm irked about a score, and I realize he's really getting mad at me. And, we're all old down there. We shouldn't be sitting around getting mad at each other. But I realized that I was right when I was, really, I was right. But I had a longtime friend named Frank M. who used to say, "Sarah, you can be very, very wrong being right." And this was certainly one of those occasions. So I said, "I'm sorry, Don. I'm really sorry." And he didn't accept it. I could tell he looked at me and he was irritated as could be. And so I really turned it on. I said, will you forgive me? And, you know, he sort of backed up against the wall at that point. And he said, oh, it's all right. But he was still mad, I know. But I got up after that, and, of course, my job is to let go of it, not be carrying something on. I was still irked like he was. But I have to let it go. I have to live my own life, go on, be cheery with the next people at the next table and so on, and not carry it. And I know the next time I ran into him at the bridge club, oh, hi, how are you? Hi, Sarah, how are you doing? And I know it took him a minute to let go of it, too. But I'll tell you, I really do, for the most part, live my life in emotional balance, and it's because I have the gift of the 10th step and all of the steps and all of you. Thanks a million.
Very nice, very pretty. Sarah may be comfortable when I walked in with that personality. I was very nervous until that. I'd like to have our second person come forth and share, and that's Ted B. Ted D.
Hello, my name is Ted. I'm a grateful alcoholic. I've got some friends here. And it's Ted, double D, because I dropped the Y after I got over 6'2". The other thing is, I couldn't understand grateful alcoholic. The first time I ever heard somebody say that, I thought they were crazy. And I have since come to understand that that is very true, that this fellowship does allow me to be very grateful for what I have. I just have to say that coming to Toronto, where I was born, because I had taken a geographic cure and moved to Montreal, and I came here from Montreal with friends. And we had the pleasure of arriving a couple of hours early at 5 o'clock in the morning, and with the expectation that there was going to be a restaurant open at 6. And we went down to the beaches where I had grown up and started my addiction. And I got the opportunity to sleep on a couple park benches, which was like deja vu. I was, I think, born with resentments because I was a breech birth, which means I was born backwards. And on top of that, it was a forcep delivery, so I never had anything to say about it. I'm a twin, and years later I got to talk to my mother, and she told me, you know, well, nowadays I could have stayed there, you know, for a little while longer, and maybe I wouldn't have been such a resentful, angry young man. I grew up in a large family, a Catholic family, and was in a school system where there was a lot of abuse, a lot of corporal punishment, and where the principals who meted out the most pain and punishment were actually advanced to being supervisors in that school system. So, I don't know. I can remember having detentions where the priest would have his cassock on, and you'd go down to the gym in your school uniform, and he'd put on a pair of boxing gloves and say, okay, you ready? And I'd have boxing gloves on. I'd say, yes, I'm ready. And then he'd punch me in the nose. I'd say, okay, detention's over. And that's how you learn that might makes right, and I guess it's also the whole adage about spare the rod and spoil the child, because they never spoiled any kids there. I think my first recollection of drinking was when I was about 8 years old. My father used to have poker games at the house, and there were spent cigars and cigarette butts and all that kind of thing in the ashtrays and poker chips around. The only time I see them now is for third, sixth, and ninth anniversaries, month anniversaries, you know. But there were beer bottles scattered around the table, and I took one of these bottles, and I had a sip of it, and I said, oh, I'm never going to drink that. And unbeknownst to me, my father was just around the corner in the kitchen. He said, yeah, give it time. And although I never saw my father, I think maybe I saw my father drunk once, but I do believe that my father was a dry alcoholic, because he was a very violent man. And this qualifies me also for another fellowship, I think, because my mother and my siblings, I was trying to help them and to make the situation a little bit better around the house all the time. My father was prone to violence where I never knew whether he was going to hit or hug. And I think the first time that I really got drunk, again, being a good Catholic boy, I'd been serving Mass, and you might expect me to say it was sacrificial wine, but it wasn't, because old Father Krunigan invited me back to his residence and was showing me his Greek wrestling sculptures, and said, you ever drink this stuff here? And he shows me a bottle of Canada Club. And I said, well, you know, my dad drinks that kind of thing. I can drink that. And I think I was probably about 13 years old at that point. No, 12, 13. And I guzzled out of that bottle. And I can remember, you know, just going to the toilet bowl after that point and just, you know, these visions of a toilet bowl. And my buddy that I'd served Mass with that day, he took me home, and there's my mother at the front door. What happened to you? And I told her that I'd been to McDonald's and eaten a bad hamburger because I was green, you know. And she escorted me into the bathroom and got me tons of tea and put me to bed. And then my father wanted me to get up and do chores the next morning, and she said that I was sick, and which I'm eternally thankful for my mother for having lied that time for me, because I certainly wasn't in any shape to do chores around the house that day. I was a very resentful young man. I think it took me years to understand that the anger and resentment that I had was because I had put myself in situations to collect that anger and resentment. That I have learned as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and practicing the steps that, and also reading the big book, that we oftentimes have put ourselves in situations where we could be hurt. And then, you know, it's the self-pity and all the resentments that come out of that that I could turn against other people. And I became very, very good at that. I remember in high school that I had many opportunities as an athlete, which I destroyed because at the final day of school I burned my school uniform in front of the principal. And he, even though I had a football scholarship to Notre Dame in the United States, he made sure that I failed phys ed. So it meant that my grades did not go through to the university. I had to go to summer school, and I wonder who got the last laugh there. It wasn't me. I had oftentimes, I think, turned the violence towards myself, too. And I've come to understand in this program that this is something that we've also done as alcoholics. I made professional choices because of my alcoholism. I think that although I thought they were good professional choices, I ended up working in the entertainment business and the bar business. So I was always close to alcohol. Go figure. I thought, you know, that it was a good career choice. Meanwhile, whenever anybody was coming along saying, well, how would you really like a career? I'd say, no, you know, it's just, I think I'm at a good place. I was always working in somebody else's bar, and come to realize in the end that, you know, the only way I could work in a bar was if I owned the place, and I never did. So I just drank to make myself feel better. As I mentioned earlier, I took the geographic cure, and I had met a woman down in Montreal, and we fell in love, and I moved to Montreal, and because I was going to have new friends there, and life was going to be different, and I wasn't going to be the resentful, angry person that I was, and I was going to make new friends. And none of that happened. Well, I made new friends, but as far as being the resentful, angry person that I was, I continued to be that person. But one of the odd things that happened, I guess, is that more and more I was involved in trying to save the world. And I put a lot of energy out into you know, community work and outside of myself because I didn't want to live inside. And in retrospect, when I look back at my life, I just see that, you know, I couldn't handle reality. I didn't want to live in reality. It was a painful place, it was a lonely place, and I was full of fear. So it was much better to be trying to change the world and angry at everybody else and externalize the whole thing. I had an interesting thing happen that my younger brother, as it being a gift, is in the fellowship. And at a certain point, seeing me doing all this community work, he said, you know, do you get paid for any of this stuff? And I said, no, I don't. And he says, well, that's grandiosity, and that's a trait of an alcoholic. And I said, oh, come on, get out of here. You know, I mean, I'm not grandiose. I'm not an alcoholic. And he says, well, listen, I'll tell you what. I'd like to send you a book. It's by Hazelton, and it's called Is There an Alcoholic in the Closet? I want you to read that book to understand a bit about me. So here's my brother sending me a book to understand about him. So he sends a book down, and I get halfway into that book, and then I say, that SOB, he's not talking about himself, he's talking about me. My brother himself had come into the program because initially his wife used to slip out at night, and he says, "Where are you going?" And she says, "I'm going to Al-Anon." And he says, "Well, isn't that a meeting for wives and relatives of alcoholics?" And she looks at him and says, "Yes." So the gifts that come to a family, because it was through my sister-in-law that my brother started in the program and that I started in the program. And as far as the daily inventory, I would have to say that before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know what a daily inventory was. I just felt bad all the time. I was just irritable. What is the expression? I mean, irritable, miscontent. You know, like a bear with a burr on its butt. And the whole idea of a personal inventory or a business inventory escaped me. And then I'd been in the program, I guess, about 2 years, and I wasn't really practicing the steps. I wasn't really working at this. And I started into an intensive workshop with men for the 12 steps, and I changed sponsors, and the gift of the program started to work as I started to work the steps. And I now am able to live in the 10th, 11th, and 12th steps. And even as I would say the best made plans of mice and men, I think to myself, well, the daily inventory, I started out with the seven deadly sins, and then in the workshop that I did with the men, we had the Joe and Charlie tape, and I got this very detailed inventory, which did not only balance the debit, but also the assets. And I was able to look and say, you know, for every thing where I was suffering, there was also something which I can celebrate at the end of the day and thank God and say, "God, thank you very much for this gift." As it would have it, though, and in as much as this is a program of progress, not perfection, there are times when I can't do my personal inventory, and one of the gifts, because nothing in God's universe is a waste, and not necessarily by happenstance. But and some of you folks would know about driving in Montreal, but my horn went out about 2 months ago. So I don't have a horn in the car. And if someone's cutting me off, first off, I'd be punching the horn. It doesn't work. So then I'd be sitting in my car shouting at them, and they can't hear anything. And then I started to laugh at the ludicrousness of this. I mean, it's insane. A guy inside his car screaming at somebody in the car in front. So I just started to relax about the whole thing. The other thing is that the heater in my car won't shut off. So, I mean, I'm constantly in a bad temper and all sweaty, so I do have to laugh about it. It's kind of foolish. And I find myself doing a lot of spot inventories while I'm driving. And actually, I would say the gift of driving in a little car like this is that I am able to test my serenity. Because if someone is cutting me off or if the traffic is really lousy, then I just have to calm down. I don't listen to my radio. I will probably pray a lot while I'm in the car. And the car is one place where I do invite God. And it does help me very much in my day-to-day living. The other inventory which I have had some success with practicing is a private inventory, and that is to say, if I know that I put myself in situations before in my life where I had false expectations, because as an alcoholic I was not seeing reality as reality, then I had to do what was called term as our private inventory, which Bill talks about as Bill sees it. On page 144, I think he talks about this private inventory around our expectations and what kind of leverage we give other people over our own life, and whether we should trust people at that point, or am I going to get hurt if I give somebody this much control or much access to myself. So those two things I have found have helped me very much, and at the end of the day, I've kept a journal since 1971. And it's a pleasure sometimes going back and reading what I have written, but a lot of times I go back there and it's just like porridge. It's just like a mash and a mesh of uh, woe is me's and a lot of drunken babbling, actually. So I really don't care to read a lot of times. It has changed, though, since I have come into this program. And for that, I am very grateful. My daily inventory helps me to live in the present. It also helps me to surrender and to be humble and to be teachable. And these are the attributes, these are the qualities which I want to go forward in my life and to live out of this. And I thank you very much for the opportunity to share here in Toronto.
The word inventory was the biggest word I think was ever induced to. There are sales marketing plans like Amway, Watkins. They draw circles, and that's how I did mine. I started with, and I had to go back till I was 3 years old because I had no genetic background to go fall back onto. I didn't even know what nationality I was. But through the pieces and everything, I brought me this far, and I'm thankful. I'd like to introduce our third speaker, and it's Upton, and I'm awful glad to meet this gentleman.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Upton. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, everybody, for being here and making this a great weekend, and thank you, Canada, for being wonderful hosts. And, yeah. I've been living in Santa Fe, New Mexico for the past 7 years, and it's quite different than Toronto, so I've been having a wonderful time here and enjoying the new experiences. Let's see. I'll tell you one thing for sure. A couple months ago, I got a letter in the mail saying would I like to speak at the World Convention on the Daily Inventory? And I said yes, but I'll tell you one thing. I focused on Daily Inventory a hell of a lot more ever since that day. And I started to think about it. And if you have a sponsor who's slacking on their fourth step or on a particular step, just send them a letter saying they need to speak on it. I swear to God, every meeting where there wasn't sure what a topic was, I'd raise my hand. Let's talk about a group inventory, daily inventory. With my sponsor, just doing it. And I'm really grateful. The past couple months, I really have seen a difference. I'm the alcoholic who, I'm a typical alcoholic. I seem to really actually put out effort when I'm in hot water. It's like a tea bag. And I'm, honestly, when I was out there, when I was drinking, before I came into AA, the firmest belief I had was I was going to die at age 27. And at age 22, I was so sick and tired of waking up every day and thinking five more years of this. And I didn't think if I committed suicide, it wouldn't work properly, and I'd just make life even more miserable than it already was. And so I lived just to survive until 27. And when I came into AA, that was one of the tools I had, was living to survive. Meaning when it really got bad, I would bust my butt just to survive. And it really wasn't about living at all. And those were my tools, and so I would work hard just to survive. And even that got miserable. And when it got miserable enough, I got a sponsor. And when that got miserable enough, I'd give him a call. When that was miserable enough, I'd actually ask for help. And those phone conversations, and on and on and on. You know, two steps forward, one step back. And Eventually, I got through 1 through 9, and that really cleared up my past. And in the first time, it was the best effort I could, and I've gone through 1 and 9 since. And each time, I figure it's practice. I get better and better at it, and it's cleaning up my past. Step 10, for me, that daily inventory is about the present. And it's really practicing step 1 through 9, but not on a grandiose scale. Just seeing bite-sized pieces. And it's taken practice to learn that, because I'm an all-or-nothing kind of guy. And keep things simple and to just take a really small, trivial aspect of my life that I trip over on a daily basis, and to look at that one thing and see that I'm powerless over it, and make a decision if I'm willing to be open-minded and see if I can turn that over and see that there's something I can do about it, and just go through the steps with it. Has made an incredible difference in my daily life. Let's see. The industry that I'm in right now is very demanding. I work about 18, 20 hours a day, 6 days a week, sometimes 7. And so it doesn't make a lot for meetings, especially in a small town of Santa Fe. But as life would have it, there are members of AA in the same workplace as me. And we do meet up on a daily basis, sometimes multiple times a day. And we don't really get to have a full meeting. But we do talk about what's going on in the moment right now. How is outside factors affecting us on the inside? And it's a godsend. They saved my life just as much as you guys in these rooms. It always seems to be the little things, but man, they are important in the moment. And they'll eat away at my insides and will quickly affect my perception of how I see the rest of the world. They'll affect my judgments on how I will react to those altered perceptions. And then they'll affect my emotions so I can justify that I was right in making those decisions. Let me tell you, I can be a complete bastard to anybody at any time. I'm still very sick. And this disease is damn sick. It's one of those things that I didn't get sick overnight, and I don't get healthy overnight. But if I'm not getting healthier, I can definitely get sicker, ever so subtly. And sometimes, like I said earlier, it's 2 steps forward, 1 step back, 2 steps forward, 1 step back. Without a daily inventory, I can subtly slip back 2 steps a day, 3 steps a day, and still think I'm moving forward, everything's great. And next thing you know, I'm absolutely miserable, just trying to survive again. Like I said, that's all I knew how to do when I first came in here. But slowly but surely, you guys have taught me how to live and how to dream. How to think about building a future. Now, what I've also learned is I can dream, but I have to do some of the footwork, and that I have to do today. And, again, I look at that as part of the daily inventory. I believe my dreams come from a higher power, and so if I follow my dreams, it's part of doing God's will. It's attraction rather than promotion. It's building upon all the wonderful foundations of AA which got me sober. And if you're drunk like I am, when you come into these rooms, you find a lot more than just sobriety and learning how not to drink, or how to drink successfully is what I was looking for when I first came in here. I found so much more, and these steps are so dynamic. And as I expand them more and more into my life, I need to keep track of everything. And that daily inventory helps, not only with my own self-deficiencies, lack of patience, quick to judge, tardiness. Oh, Jesus. If there's a word for it, I got it. Or I'm susceptible to it. I've got defects that are in slumber for years at a time and then crop up all of a sudden. So it's one of those things where I got to check in, not only with my sponsor and a higher power, but with myself, because I need practice with honesty. I need practice with reliability and consistency. I was always a great sprinter, but not a great marathon runner. And I can't blame cigarette smoke for that. It's just part of my makeup. And doing something on a consistent basis has always been a challenge. Always been a challenge. And for the longest time, the one thing I could do on a daily basis was show up at meetings. And but when I reached the year of just showing up at meetings in AA, I was absolutely amazed. I'd never done anything for a year. Anything. And then having relationships with people in AA and a sponsor for multiple years was amazing. And slowly but surely, through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got to know me. And at first, it wasn't a pretty picture. I did not like who I saw at the end of step five. But it was an actual, precise location of where I was. I always thought I was 10 miles further, or sometimes in extreme cases, 100 miles back at the lowest of low. And I was wondering why I really couldn't make progress, because I couldn't locate myself where I was. But at the end of step five, I knew exactly where I was. From then, it was real easy to start moving forward. And step 10 is pretty much like a daily GPS locator. Where the hell is Upton? Where's his mind? Where's his emotions? Where's his yearnings? And chances are they're all in different places. But bringing them all together in one place for me helps me move on throughout the day. And also, it clears my head so that tomorrow can be fresh. Because I am great at collecting emotional baggage, at resentments, at, I don't know, I need a source, but it's all the same, it seems. How am I doing on time? Anyways, the daily inventory has kept my perspective on autofocus with my higher power since I've really started paying attention because of being asked to speak here. And my recovery ebbs and flows. I wish it always could be Mr. AA striving to be the best. But it doesn't work that way for me. And I doubt it ever will. But that's why I have you guys. And that's why I have the steps. And that's why I have life directing me and shifting me to do things I normally wouldn't do. And I appreciate every day that I have and every day I can share with you. So enjoy the rest of the conference and thank you very much.
Is Sonny S. in the crowd? If he is, can you put his hand up? Sonny S. from District 7 in Nova Scotia. I know there has been three speakers picked, and I spoke to an hour and a half meeting, and I'm having a problem here. But I don't know what the process is, if we can end it or not. Pardon? Thank you very much. I would, okay. I had one back, a backup, but I guess you must left. I'd like to thank everybody, and I'd like to thank the speakers. I really enjoyed them. I'd like to thank them for relaxing me. I'd like to thank you people. I hope you all have a beautiful Canada Day. I shall not ever forget this day. And I want you to know one thing, and I'm going to use this in closing. After the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, of the first 100 men and women who treated this program and said they were recovered, treated their Alcoholics Anonymous as a calling or an avocation in life. I treat mine as a calling in life. Thank you. Can you help me close with the Lord's Prayer? Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Go and be sweet.